Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Whoa, a lot of show planned for you today. First, Rotten Tomatoes, always a crowd pleaser. And then, oh, nobody, Christian Bale, Matt Damon, James Mangold as well. So that's coming. First, Castrol Edge, stronger under pressure. Engines can lose up to 10% of performance due to friction. Castrol Edge with fluid titanium transforms under pressure to keep metal from rubbing and robbing. Three times stronger, fool, than leading full synthetic against viscosity breakdown. Use what the pros use. Castrol Edge, formulated in ways to exceed the highest and toughest industry standards. It is the edge. It's Castrol Edge. Support for the Adam Carolla podcast comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Imagine how it feels to have an award-winning team by your side through every step of the mortgage process. That's exactly what you get with Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage does more to help you understand the home buying process so you can get exactly what you need. They've helped millions of Americans achieve their dream of home ownership. When you're ready to purchase your home, and the home of your dreams, they can help you as well. J.D. Power has ranked Quicken Loans highest in customer satisfaction for primary mortgage origination 9 years in a row and highest in mortgage servicing 6 years in a row. When you work with them, you get more than just a loan because Rocket Mortgage is more than just a lender. Right, Dawson?
Get started online at rocketmortgage.com/Adam. For J.D. Power award information, visit jdpower.com. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Push button, get mortgage. Back to the toolbox, they called him England Dan because he faked a British accent and he loved the Beatles. Sometimes the truth is stupid.
Hello, yeah, it's been a while. Not much. How about you? I'm not sure why I called. I guess I really just wanted to talk to you. And I was thinking maybe later on we could get together for a while. It's been such a long time and I really do miss your smile. I'm not talking about moving in and I don't want to change your.
From Carolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, Matt Damon and Christian Bale. With Gina Grad on news, Bald Brian on sound effects, and a round of the Rotten Tomatoes game. And now, we can go back to laughing at Bald Brian. Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but to get it on. Man, did you get it on? Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for sharing. Got a big show planned for you today. Good day, Gina Grad.
Good day to you.
And Bald Brian.
I'm going
to
make fun of you later.
We can't forget that.
All right. So, a couple things. First off, I heard that song for, I'm not talking England Dan and John Ford Coley. That song was super popular when I was 11 or something, and I never got the, I'm not talking about moving in. I never got the moving in. Right. And moving in didn't mean anything to me. Sure. Like, I'm not talking about moving in. Like, it's a weird
moving
thing.
What?
Like, talk about moving stuff.
Yeah, right. Moving furniture.
And I'm not going to rent a truck, but I do want to come over tonight and do something that rhymes with truck. My whole life, I was like, I'm not talking about Meridian. Like, I couldn't, I didn't know what the word, I didn't know what moving in.
Growing up with Star Wars, I always thought I was not talking about Millennium.
Moving in is a weird thing to shoehorn into that melodic whatever, and it's not very poetic when you're writing a song. Anyway, I got a subtle Mike August story. But effective.
I have a hair question.
Yes.
Is this story that your hair is telling that you just jumped in the pool?
I did go in the pool.
No, there's gel in there.
Okay, because it seems like it's wet from the pool. Maybe.
It is wet from the pool, and there is gel. This is a rare occasion.
Up top, Gina.
Where both of you are correct. It is now, I'm now at the point when I swim with my head out on the way to the deep end, and there's now steam coming out of my mouth. I'm at that point where I'm blowing the steam out. And then it's underneath for the underwater swim to the other end, because it is now officially cold outside at night where I am. All right, so so much to get into. We got our mic thing. So I want to rely on you guys with a lean toward Bald Brian, because I'm going to talk to James Mangold later today, and if you have a question, I will field it and give it, or he will field it, and I'll serve it up to him. So I am going later today, when we hang up here, to the Peterson Automotive Museum, and I'm going to interview Matt Damon and Christian Bale and James Mangold, and then we'll marry it to this show, and then you guys shall hear that, in theory. I always have this, there's always a little part of my mind that goes, one of them's not going to be there, or somebody got sick, or somebody whatever. But we are going to go talk to those guys about this movie that I've been thinking about for a number of years, because I was involved with it. Now, it's a little bit tricky because the book, Go Like Hell, which is a A.J. Bain book, who's a really good writer, wrote Arsenal of Democracy. These are very good books, very informative books.
He was featured throughout the documentary, right? He was the guy who was kind of telling the story.
In the 24-hour war. That book was optioned for years. His Go Like Hell book was optioned for years. And then at the end, they didn't renew it. And then they made the movie. So it's a little...
That doesn't sound
fair. There's a little bit of a lawsuit floating around. Yeah. And I don't know if anyone wants to go down that
road. Definitely bring that up. Lead with that.
That's your opener.
So, and then the doc I made had AJ in it, was based loosely on the book. So it's an interesting kind of cross pollination there. So there's that to get into, perhaps, or not. also, and I don't know if you guys have any Christian Bale questions Matt Damon questions, but if you'd like, put it down at some point. I'll bring it with you, and I'll try to weave it in there.
Well, I have a question for James Mangold. James Mangold, who do you think is hotter, Matt Damon or Christian Bale?
Okay.
Oh, you took my question. Oh,
sorry.
So then the subtle Mike Ogg, and then we'll play Rotten Tomatoes and do the news as well, and we'll try to cobble the whole show together. Now, the funny, subtle Mike August, I'm very interested in people not knowing what I'm asking or what I'm talking about or what I mean.
What do you mean?
Like, there's sometimes you'll say to people, you know, like you'll say to somebody, how do you want that steak? And you'll go, well done. And they'll go, well, you want a ton of steak?
Right.
And
you'll go,
just a basic misunderstanding of the facts.
Why would I ask for it? Like, no, I...
Yeah. In no universe does it make sense.
Everything is just context. It's like context. Like, you know what people do. Right. You know kind of their rhythms. You know kind of what they're saying. They invert things. They flip-flop things. They speak and the wrong name comes out of the mouth. But you know who we're talking about. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or what we're talking about?
Following
I feel like when you're tuned in, you don't have to stop people all the time, and if there's somebody named Dave, and somebody's talking fast about Dave, and Dave's late, and Dave showed up, and Dave, and at some point they go, and then I come back, and Dan's just sitting in the lobby. He's just eyeballing. He's not even saying that.
Whoa,
there's a separate person? Like,
are
I
you
know,
telling a new story?
I know the context. I know what you're talking about. I follow. I'm listening. Yep. I so many people, like, huh, what? They stop. Right. So I said to, we're sitting on a flight to Vegas, and I said to Mike, how's your wife's insurance business doing? And he said, that's all right, just kind of breaking even or whatever. His wife's name is Doreen. She's a real nice lady, and she's a hard worker. And I like that. And I said, is she going in every day? And he goes, oh yeah, she's 6 days. She's going in 6 days a week. Wow. Monday through Friday, and she goes in on Sunday. And I said, she goes in on Sunday. Why not go in on Saturday? And he goes, she's got to have one day off to be with the kids. I go, Mike, I'm not saying why not 7 days a week. You think, for example, I'm like, why doesn't your wife work every single day all the time? I'm saying it's weird to go into the office on Sunday versus a lot of people put in a Saturday and then Sundays so with the whatever.
It's the Lord's Day.
So when he said she goes in on Sunday, and I go, "What? Why not Saturday?" He's like, "Well, she's got to have one day off."
The question is, why Sunday, not Saturday?
Right? Not why not Saturday too?
I didn't say. Yeah. See, I didn't burn the calories of saying instead of Sunday.
That's your problem. Sunday.
Right? Because I think you know the content.
Yeah.
I would never say to anybody, "Why doesn't your spouse work every single day?" Why? I would never say it. By the way. Juxtaposed to my wife? Are you kidding me? Like, I think I'd be sitting there, like, judging, but there's still one day in the week she could be working.
Yeah, she's leaning. She could be cleaning.
Like, so I don't burn the calories of saying, why not this instead of that? I can just go, why not Saturday? Because within this conversation, you should know what I mean. You shouldn't take that as me saying, why doesn't she work every single day?
That's an absurd premise.
But does
also coming from me, because I don't do that. Like, I don't, you know, I know people, like, my wife doesn't work. Other people's wives do work. Like, I never go, like, every, why is your wife working every single day?
No.
My wife's on the roof of our house right now spreading asphalt.
Every damn night.
And also, it is peculiar to work 5 days a week and Sundays.
Yes.
So that's also, you know, the context of this question because you phrased it this way.
Right.
So when I say what's wrong with Saturday, I cannot be talking about doing it 7 days a week. I have to be talking about the norm, which is a lot of people do work Saturdays, but rarely is anyone on this pattern.
We cut to home and August is like, his wife's like, how's the trip? Oh, Adam wants you to work every day of the week.
Jesus Christ, I had to yell at him.
What did you guys talk about? Why you don't work enough?
Do you ever adjust for your audience since you know what you're getting when you deal with Mike?
Yeah, that's really on you.
Yeah, it's on me.
I mean, after this many years, come on.
I felt like this one was pretty obvious. First off, I think it's rare that people have a pattern where they just go into work on Sunday and not on Saturday, unless there's some religion involved. And just, you know, and he just said Saturday when I yelled at him and then we drilled down a little. He just said Saturday's more the kids' activities day, which is a fine answer. I'm just saying he picked a weird rhythm. I questioned the rhythm to bring it to a normal rhythm, which is some people do work Saturdays. And I didn't feel like I needed to, but evidently I do. I must.
Hope to learn a lesson.
I did. Yeah. A valuable lesson.
And then I away from this.
I try to save a couple of syllables going in, and then I waste it complaining when he screws it up.
Yeah. You're going to pay for those double.
That's right. All right. So also apropos to something, which is our drive to the airport. Can we make a rule? Can we make a rule that when you are driving at a fast pace on a street, a main street, like 35 miles an hour is the speed limit. If you're going to go 50 on that street, which, by the way, I encourage and I'm impressed by, but if you're going to be hauling ass, like on occasion, there's the street out in front of us, people will haul ass on that street, you'll be poking out to turn right. They're coming at you, closing the distance fast. You're not allowed to honk and go, hey, what's up?
Yeah.
Because you're driving at increased speed that is closing this thing up faster, right?
Right.
So you're allowed to drive fast, but you can't have an attitude about it because the reason we're having this little issue, me poking out and you're coming up on me, is because you're going twice the speed limit.
Right.
So we're on the way to the airport. I'm in the left lane. We're doing 34, 35. I start to go into the right lane, and as I start to go, I see in my rear view someone's doing 50. Like, they're coming up fast. So I go right back into my lane. I don't get into the lane. I start to go there. I don't even know if I break the line, and then I slide back into whatever. As the person passes me, they lay on the horn and give me the look. Now, hey, bitch, I fixed it. I fixed it. I started to do something, and then I went back. I saw you. I went back. Still the necessity to honk as you're going by. It was awesome, though, that a few moments later, they got caught up in a left turn lane, and I flew past them and laid on the horn. Felt good.
Ah, good.
And then on the way...
The retribution horn.
On the way back, Mike was, like, poking out of the Jet Suite X parking lot or whatever, and there was... It was kind of a weird intersection where you think there'd be a stop sign, but there wasn't. So Mike was like poking out, and then he was like, oh, there is no stop sign. And he stopped the car, and then the guy who went and turned just gave him the stink eye and gave him the horn the whole time. I'm saying when you fix your behavior, you should not be allowed to honk at that behavior.
I agree.
It was corrected.
Right.
The horn should be punitive, i.e. you fucked up and you got to know about it, or like, hey, watch out, we're about to get into, you know, there's about to be a situation here.
No sour grapes, especially like when they're unnecessary.
Hey, man, should have done that. Or, you know, like that kind of thing.
Or I hope you learned your lesson.
Right.
Well, it's strange when you're speeding and someone's going to slide into the lane in front of you, being me, and then sees you and goes back.
Right.
So... We've completed this transaction,
right?
You don't need to honk when you go past me. I actually I'm on your side. I saw you and I moved back.
What sociopathic?
It's weird, right?
Yeah. All right, it's very selfish.
All right, we have the Rotten Tomatoes game. I was gonna say, Jesus Christ! I was thinking about my world. So it's off to the Peterson to talk to. Christian Bale and Damon and James Mangold.
Yeah.
Then Mike Lynch meets me at the Peterson. Then we drive back from the Peterson. He's flying in and we work on the book because we're in the car. It's a long haul back to my house. Then Mike Lynch sleeps over at my house.
Ooh, okay.
And then we get up at 6 and we take off at 6:30 to drive down to Fontana to do Jay Leno's garage.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Lynch gets back into the car, and we work on the book to Fontana. Then Mike Lynch does whatever in Fontana, works on the book.
Sleeps.
And then we get back in the car, and we drive back from Fontana.
Oh, is he coming to the event? Awesome. I didn't know that.
He's coming out here for the Laugh with Paul
Bryant. Is this the first you're hearing
this? This is literally the first I heard of, but I hope he's on the list.
So he... then he gets back. We get back in the car. We come back to where I live. And then that night, we get back in the car. We work on the book when we're in the car. And we go to Laughs with Paul Bryant. Yeah. And then do a comedy set. And then back in the car, work on the book, back home.
Awesome.
That's his... That's my schedule.
Pound That's how out. You work on a Saturday.
That's right. Why not Sunday?
I'm telling you, there's so much downtime in the car now. Yeah. If you guys come up with something constructive to do, it ain't downtime anymore.
I had the thought. I didn't really consider it, but it flashed in my mind today because we're recording this on a Friday. Laughs about Brian's tomorrow. I'm obsessively trying to get prepared for, you know, my set, my hosting, whatever. And I'm thinking, like, I should take an Uber to work today so I can have like 35 minutes to, like, you know, really like work on, you know, the outline, the show, the, you know, the prep, the whole thing. And it's like, no, that's a waste of money. But it was 35 minutes. I really could.
That's tax deductible.
There and back, by the way. That's 70 minutes I could have probably used.
A few years ago, a friend of mine, we were driving and it was my car and I'm driving and I just had a lot on my mind and I was trying to work some stuff out. And they said the most generous thing that I'd ever heard that I never would have thought of. Do you want me to drive so you can think? I was like, that was really nice. Just because I had a lot of things to try and figure out.
Yeah, there's a lot. I remember years ago, we were working on one of the books. We were driving from, I don't know, Spokane to Seattle or something. I can't remember where, but we had a long haul. And Mike Lynch was in the car. And Lynch was in the car, and I was in the car. And Mike August was reading the book. My book, yeah. While I was driving, and me and Lynch were like commenting or whatever. Like
that's important. Yeah, yeah. You got to hear the book. You
know what I mean? My God, everybody, yeah. hear your book, because that's what I'm doing when I'm in the car.
You may not with your reading skills, you may not have done this, but when I read my book, like at the end of my, like read it to myself, your mind just corrects things. You know what
yes.
I mean? Like they just
yes.
they just gloss over things. They like, oh, I think subliminally, you're like, oh, I know what I meant.
Yes.
Whereas
there is that. Yes.
If someone else reads it to you,
how it falls
like,
on
oh.
your ear.
No, I'm telling you, the big question is Mike is not Hardy Stock, Mike Lynch. He's gonna get car sick in that car.
Oh, yeah, he can't.
Because he normally reads it to me from his desk on a computer, and I'm in the car. I'm worried about him getting car sick.
Put him back seat.
We'll work on it. I'll crack a window. Let him put his head out. All right, so let's see. We got the Rotten Tomatoes game to play. Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Let me hit the Castrol first, and then we'll roll into that. Stronger under pressure. Engines can lose up to 10% of performance due to friction. We don't want that. Castrol Edge with fluid titanium transforms under pressure. Three times,
fool.
Stronger than leading full synthetics. Against viscosity breakdown, Edge formula always exceeds toughest industry standards. It is the best. It is Castrol Edge, everybody. All right. Shall we play the Rotten Tomatoes game?
Yeah.
Listen to that noise. It's a high falsetto voice that can only mean one thing, and you can feel it. Got some names of flicks. And the gang makes their picks, guessing if it's rotten or fresh. If they guess it exactly, we'll get a bonus 5. It's the Rotten Tomatoes game. You know how we do it. Give me the Rotten Tomatoes game. Now it's time to play it.
So before we dive into the Ford v. Ferrari interviews, we're going to dedicate this game to one of the film's stars, American hero Matt Damon.
All right.
We all know Matt Damon is no stranger to being part of an all-star cast, and back in the early 2000s, he and a few up-and-comers by the names of Clooney, Pitt, and Roberts got together for a series of high-stakes heist movies. So we're going to talk about the first sequel, 2004's Ocean's 12.
Ocean's 11 is really great.
We got you.
Let's see. Ocean's 11. Then there was Ocean's 12. Then I didn't mind the Ocean's 8 or whatever, the all-chick version.
No, that was not a good movie.
No, it's not good. But I'm saying I didn't mind it because people are good-looking. And it's always kind of stylized and stuff. And it's just sort of, there's some movies that are good, but sort of hard to watch. And then there are movies that are bad and easier
to watch.
And
those are good plain movies.
The all-chick version is easy-ish to watch, but you shouldn't watch it anyway. All right, so Ocean's 11, what's the one where they started by threatening to throw Elliot Gould off the building? Is that this one?
That's 13. Number 13.
Oh, that's 13. Oh. So that was bad.
This is the one where they raise a building, right, in Venice to, like, get underneath it, I think?
Yeah.
Or something like that?
So this is the one that was, the first one was good, the second one was bad, and then this is the one that angered me because George Clooney said, yes, this one was bad, but 13 is good.
Okay.
Oh.
I'm giving you guys too much information. Okay. Then I got angry at 13.
This has a legitimately great scene where Julia Roberts' character impersonates Julia Roberts because in the context of the film, like, hey, you look just like Julia Roberts.
That's and then pretty winky.
Bruce Willis. I kind of like the meta look at it themselves. Bruce Willis was there, like, who knew Julia Roberts? It's pretty great.
All right.
All right. 2004.
Okay. It's a very charismatic cast. And for that, I say 52.
Yeah, this is a really middling movie, but I think it had goodwill because it was the same writer-director, Steven Soderbergh. It was all the same cast. Mm-hmm. Everyone loved the first one, so I think it got a little goodwill bump. I went 76.
Well, I sure as hell hope Adam's right because I, too, said 52.
Ooh. Ocean's 12 is rotten.
Good.
At 55.
Okay. Ooh.
Also, you know those movies where within the plot of the movie they reveal something, meaning... it was Ocean's 11, I think, or maybe it was 13 or whatever it is. But at some point, they had some magical elixir that Matt Damon could dab on that would make all women attracted to you no matter what.
That must have been 13 because I haven't seen 13.
See if you can...
He put on his own face.
Well, no, because he had a big nose on. He had the Cyrano de Bergerac nose on. Was it 13?
Yeah, that's 13.
Oh. So at some point, they're like, hey... how are we going to seduce this woman? Like, how are we going to get her naked or whatever? And it's like, here, take this little vial. It works every time. And they show him, like, dab it on. Right. And then, you know, you hear the chimes, right. The wind chimes. And she's like, oh, let me help you with that belt. So when you're watching the movie, you're like, hey, if you've got that elixir, you don't need what's in the vault.
Right.
Oh. You're now a kabillionaire.
A different movie.
Yeah, you run the world.
You've cured cancer. Yeah. You essentially, if you have that elixir, you can sell that.
Forget about the vault.
Yeah.
You'll have a bidding war by every major drug company on the planet, and you will get you'll get 20 times what's worth what's in that vault.
Austin Powers did a good job of lampooning that whole concept where it's like, I'm going to ransom them for $1 million. Like, sir, Globex Corp makes $20 billion dollars a year.
Yeah, the Gilroy pheromones is what it was called, and... yes, again, stop the movie. Forget what's in the vault. We got what's in the vial. All right, sorry. Here we go.
Speaking of high stakes, our next film is all about poker. Co-written by friend of the pod, Brian Koppelman, Damon goes all in to take down the enigmatic KGB played by John Malkovich. Whatever your guess is, don't splash the pot. It's 1998's Rounders.
Don't sleep on Ed Norton in Rounders.
No.
He's a worm.
Good movie.
I love this movie.
And it's also one of those movies... with Koppelman where you go, man, that's writing. Like, I look at rom-coms or horror movies and I go, I could write that. But when you get the real technical stuff, you go, someone's got to write that.
Where have you gone, Gretchen Mol?
Yeah.
All right. This is a good movie. And
I like this movie.
People should like this movie, but are we talking low 70s? Are we talking high 80s, you know? I really don't know. There's nothing to... The thing that's frustrating is when it comes in at 71, you go, really? That many people just said it was below a C-.
Yeah, it's surprising.
Like, how do you not watch this movie and just go,
yeah,
it's good.
It's undeniably good.
And the bar is 60%, right? So it's like, I don't get why all... like, movies like this, why wouldn't they just be 100%? Because everyone goes, well, it's good enough to...
yeah,
it's a C or B minus or whatever. It's a B plus. Like, why wouldn't it just be 100%? But it never is.
John Turturro's great in this.
All right.
Who's the old Jew who was in Crimes and Misdemeanors? I'm blanking on his name.
Oh, I'll figure it out in a second. He was in the original, the old Jew from Crimes and Misdemeanors.
From Ed Wood. Why am I blanking on his
name?
It was in the
original Mission Impossible.
Oh, no shit?
He was in the TV Mission Impossible, I'm pretty sure.
Chris, are you Googling old Jew?
We can all see his face.
Martin Landau.
Martin Landau.
There we go.
See if he was originally in the Mission Impossible TV version. All right, you guys locked in?
Yes.
No, hold on. Sorry.
He was.
Yeah, it was Martin Landau was in that. Yeah.
Okay, you got a number.
All right, I got 81.
I think it's been kind of a cult classic. I don't know if it was reviewed great upon release. 73.
74.
Rounders is fresh at 65%.
Oh, my.
Yeah, I should have gone lower.
And the people have it at 87.
It's a really good movie.
Why 65? Like, what's in it? First off, there's no surprises. I mean, in terms of, I thought it was going to be this kind of movie, and it was that kind of movie. Like, it is as advertised. Right. A lot of good performances, good intrigue, and why not? People had it at 87. All right. Here we go.
Well, director Doug Liman
directed
The Bourne Identity, For the sequel, director Paul Greengrass stepped in, giving the film a grittier, some would say more nauseating, handheld look.
Paul Greengrass is great.
Matt Damon reprises his role of Jason Bourne for the 2003 sequel in The Bourne Supremacy.
I'm shocked at how many Matt Damon movies I haven't seen.
First one was good. Second one was good, too.
This is a good example of a trilogy where all three movies work. I love the third one.
All right.
Oh, man.
I'm...
Was this super. Was this one as good?
I'm lazy and I want to save ink, so I just went with 81 again.
Okay. 87.
77.
For the first time in a few weeks, we have a 5-point deduction.
Mm. That's me.
It's been a long time.
The Bourne Supremacy is fresh at 81.
Damn it!
Yeah, oh, wow.
I knew that 81.
That was a little higher.
Wow.
Shoot, I needed that 5 points.
Yeah, I needed that too.
Now, speaking of great directors, is there anyone better than the Coen brothers?
And people have it at 90. I think critics are, they judge action movies and comedies like too harshly. Yeah. Like just they're good. Like what?
This
why
is completely effective? Is everything you want this kind of action movie to be?
Yeah. Why isn't it below? It just should be 100% because it's above 60% for everybody, right?
Okay. Should be.
All right.
In 2010, the Coen brothers took on a classic John Wayne Western, recasting Jeff Bridges alongside Damon, and featuring a breakout performance from newcomer Haley Steinfeld. Adam always preaches about the importance of grit. Mm-hmm. But how do you guys feel about true grit?
I've only seen the original.
This is a movie that I really enjoyed, and not everybody enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed it. This is my Hateful Eight. Which I enjoyed, this movie I really enjoyed as well. I thought Bridges was great. Haley Steinfeld was great. Matt Damon, Mr. LaBeouf, or whatever his name was
LaBeouf.
Good. LaBeouf.
We settled this.
It's a lot of good stuff in there. Yeah. But it's a remake of a classic, so that's tough.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Good performances. I couldn't figure out the end. Did we ever figure out the end?
You were bummed by the fact that she was like reminiscing in a voiceover, like he died years later or some timeline.
There was
thing.
A timeline thing that bumped me at the end, which I couldn't figure out if we're in the past or the future.
I found this movie almost completely forgettable. It hits the mark. You know, it's Coen Brothers, so how bad can it be? But it's not bad. It was, but for me, just like in one ear, in one eye, out the other.
This is, yes. So again, Hateful Eight. And this movie are the two I like that you didn't.
And speaking of Western, speaking of James Mangold, one movie I have not seen was a remake, 310 to Yuma.
Oh, that's a good movie.
That's his movie.
That's got Bale in it,
I know.
Too.
So bring that up.
That's a nice movie. All right. Don't think the critics loved it, but it's a good movie with solid performances.
That's a good cast.
And a good cast. And I'm worried. I bet the people have it higher than the critics. But I still think it's a good movie. 68.
Oh, this is where I make my comeback. This is up for Best Picture. I'm going with 91.
I split the difference with Brian the Liar.
But you hated this movie.
I did hate this movie.
How do you not interpret Brian by now in this game?
I don't like this movie.
I gave it 10 points just because of what Brian
said. Hope I never give up my innocence, girl. You better hope.
I said 75.
True Grit is fresh at 96%.
God damn it. You turn me down. I love this movie.
You two people have met, yes?
Let the record show that I did not lie. I don't love this movie.
The whole time I'm looking at Ken, like, Brian knows. He's very quiet. Brian is very quiet.
It's obvious that Brian knows.
I almost let it slip like this is up for Best Picture. This was a well-received movie.
I love this movie, but I thought they punish... When they remake classics, I thought they punish them sometimes.
I think True Grit, 310 to Yuma is pretty high. Like, I think if it's the right formula with the direct, Coen Brothers, man, he's giving them bad review.
God damn you, I love this movie. Right.
In our final film, the Great Wall of China is under attack from, wait for it, alien monsters.
Oh, no.
And only Matt Damon with his trusty bow and arrow. And a team of European mercenaries can fend off the CGI beasts and save the world, or China, or something. It's 2017's The Great Wall.
Is it 99 or 100?
It's got great.
Wait, I'm sorry. I have to say that this is starring Matt Damon and Chinese people.
What?
All right.
That's the forecast.
Great in the title.
Yeah. All right. This movie was only made for the Chinese market and for China. Yeah. There's no other reason
for it to exist.
It wouldn't exist, and Matt Damon wouldn't fight killer ants on top of an old wall. I have seen this movie.
Oh, no.
From like start to finish?
You have an advantage.
Soup to nuts?
I've seen a lot of it.
Okay.
Because
he had to get up and fill up his drink.
I'll tell you where you get me. You get me in maritime disaster movies. Mm. At sea, high seas, World War II, at sea. You got me. And you always get me with giant killer insect movies.
Noted.
Always down with that.
Edge of Tomorrow.
Yes.
Yeah.
Always down with giant killer insects. So I watch a lot of this movie. You know, it's professionally made.
I didn't try to throw me off.
Okay, Brian.
I never saw the boom mic once. It's well, you know. Crafted good CGI and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
Now, look, there's people that can go zero here. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting.
That's a bold move. It's
but,
a close game.
But it's interesting for your 5-point deduction.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you could go six, but that's probably not going to get you the five. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it had enough action and everything. All right, I'm going bold. I'm going zero.
Whoa.
Oh, shit. Okay, I went with my Halloween costume circa 1992. Mark Gray, 17.
I was going to say 18, and I wrote 12.
The Great Wall is rotten, but not that rotten, at
36%. Whoa! Wow. That's a hit. That's a runaway hit.
Wow.
Must have been enough scared critics, like scared of China critics or Chinese critics.
The landscape was majestic.
Yeah, damn it. I just screwed myself.
The Ace Man had the lead the whole way, but that 36 points, will it come back to bite him? Gina Gratt coming in at 61.
Okay.
You're on the podium. Bald Brian besting Gina by 2 points at 59.
Damn, bitch.
Leaving Adam Carolla.
I deserve to win.
You do.
And when I say leaving Adam Carolla, I mean you left. You're gone. 78, third place. Brian wins.
Oh, man. I went with zero. And it should have been a zero.
That's crazy. At 30-whatever percent.
Well, it should have been a zero in the fact that just like rounders should be 100.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, 60 is the Mason-Dixon line. There's 36% of reviewers shouldn't have it have it above that. It was a horrible movie. But I think maybe there were some Chinese folks involved with the reviewing that thing.
That makes
or
a lot
something.
Of sense.
It makes sense. Because how do you get that, you know, into the 30s?
It's impressive.
It's easily a low teen, single digit movie.
You should bring that up
today.
I will bring that up today.
Sure.
Yeah, all right.
It's the Rotten Tomatoes game. You know how we do it.
All right. Check out the official Lakers podcast, by the way, on Podcast One. And good podcasts on what's going on with the Lakers, who are back and in rare form, are coming back into championship form. All right, we'll have, yes.
Real quick, you know, I thought of a commonality between you and the three men you'll be interviewing, Damon, Mangold, and Bale.
Mm.
You've all appeared at the Oscars. Well, not you on stage, but you know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah.
Damon, you know, won for writing.
It's a nice break.
That's right. And Christian Bale has won multiple Oscars, I think. And James Mangold nominated for writing Logan just a couple years ago.
All right.
And of course, you've written it. Talk some Oscar talk. Like, hey, as fellas who've been to the Oscars multiple times, let's talk.
All right. We will take ourselves a break. We'll have Matt Damon and Christian Bale and James Mangold next. And then we'll come back after that and do some news.
The holidays are around the corner. It's time to drink too much, eat too much, and fight about Trump at the dinner table. Luckily, we've got just what you need to make the most of this most wonderful time of the year. Introducing the Corolla Christmas Stocking. The custom embroidered stocking is adorned with the hand-knit word, acehole, sewed on by talented elves and or children from the Orient. What's inside? Glad you asked.
With your purchase of the Corolla Christmas stocking, you'll get an ACS Nativity Scene t-shirt featuring Max Apata as baby Jesus and Adam as Mother Mary, a custom Happy Birthday Jesus ornament, 4 Corolla Drinks wine glasses, plus 2 bottles of your choice, all for only $99. And for those who want to go big for the holiday season, you can also purchase the Stocking Scrapbook Combo for only $175. Get the stocking and the 10 years of ACS scrapbook, signed by the entire network for the ultimate Corolla fan in your life. So get to CorollaDrinks.com today and get ready. The holidays are coming.
All right, so here we are, Christian Bale, Matt Damon. Good to see you guys. Ford v. Ferrari. Loved the movie. Loved it. And Christian, pull the mic, sorry, up close to the soup cooler there. I'd worked on a documentary, the 24-Hour War, which was same topic, and also did a Shelby documentary. So I came in loaded with information and sort of worried that I was going to be bumped, and I wasn't. I loved
Fantastic.
It. So, and everyone I saw it with loved it as well. So congratulations, number one, on knocking it. How the ballpark. And how much into cars or the sport or the hobby were you guys into before you started the film? Matt, you can start.
I wasn't, which I think was a an asset because along with the director, we talked about that. He didn't ever fetishize the cars because he wasn't a car guy, you know, and so it's you're always going just for story. And this is a really wonderful story that I think transcends cars, and so people who aren't car people, I think, will really enjoy it.
Yeah, I totally agree. It was all a lot of heart and like any movie, like Rocky wasn't really a boxing movie. It was a movie about heart and overcoming adversity and all the things. And boxing becomes, pardon the pun, the vehicle to just express all that. So Christian, how about you?
I think more than some, but nothing like you. Like what I loved, it was a very bonding experience. In between my dad and myself, we would watch Formula One when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. One time got to go to Brands Hatch, absolutely mind blowing, loved it. It was era of Alan Prost and Senna and Niki Lauda. Saw Senna tragically, you know, die on the TV. So had that past and was aware of Le Mans. As well. So I knew Shelby, I knew Le Mans, but I didn't know Ken Miles, and I didn't know this story about 66.
Ken Miles, after doing the documentary, I just said, the story is Ken Miles. Like, that's the crazy story. I mean, everyone knew Carroll Shelby. Yeah. He's a household name. Nobody knew Ken Miles, mm-hmm. and nobody knew the tragedy of that story. And, you know, I don't want to spoil it, but...
Well, we could have done a whole movie on the ending.
Yeah, on just what happened to Ken Miles and how that works and how people's memories and they move on and you don't even know this character. Even amongst car enthusiasts, I would have to bring up the name Ken Miles and they didn't know about it. And I thought you did such an amazing job playing him because he's an interesting, quirky, different kind of guy.
I think it was a real saving grace. You know, the guy was a very strong character. He just would not compromise at all. He was a real purist, racer. He considered himself first and foremost a mechanic, but was a phenomenal racer. And that search for this kind of perfect lap and this purity of experience was like his saving grace, but his absolute Achilles heel as well. He just was constantly shooting himself in the foot. Winning battles, losing the war completely, and now getting long in the tooth and not really having any opportunity until Shelby recognizes in his friend, if he would just shut up for once and let Shelby just give him some kind of strategy, then he can put him there. And the fact that these guys bloody did it, you know, and they took on God in the form of Enzo Ferrari, and they bloody won. It's phenomenal.
You know, it's funny. Someone was interviewing me, and they were talking about how mighty Ford was and how small Ferrari was. But I said, you know, Mike Tyson was the smallest heavyweight in his era, and he just knocked everyone's ass out. Mm-hmm. So Ferrari was Mike Tyson. Like, sure, they were a little boutique company, not that well-funded, but they mm-hmm. won all the time. So in a way, they were the giant up against Ford, who was physically the giant, but didn't have those wins. It's an incredible story. I know you got to meet Peter Miles, the son of Ken Miles, which is much of the much of the story revolves around Ken and Peter, and Peter, this, he must be over the moon about this.
I hope so. I do hope so. I watched the film with Peter and with Peter's daughter, and it was obviously really bloody moving. Having seen the film, you'll understand why. For that, and he was so helpful to me in telling me stories about his dad, giving me, you know, personal artifacts and photographs and all of that. He was really generous, and I would be, you know, texting him photographs from the set throughout. You know, yeah, it was wonderful to have him around.
Matt, how much did you know about Shelby? Because I, you know, it's always funny whenever they go, Matt Damon's going to play Carroll Shelby. I go, I know Matt Damon. He can't play Carroll. Then you see him, and he's Carroll Shelby. Like you became Carroll Shelby.
Yeah, I didn't know a lot. I mean, I obviously knew he's kind of an iconic guy, but I didn't know a lot about him, and I didn't know a lot about him in relation to this story and this relationship that he had with Miles, which I thought was really, you know, it was really the kind of the basis of what I was doing in the movie. I mean, it was interesting to watch, go back and look at stuff on Shelby when he would talk about Miles, and he'd get choked up, and that this experience of Le Mans 66, what these guys went through, I mean, it really, I think, stayed with him for the rest of his life, and he would say, you know, Ken Miles is a hell of an engineer, you know, he'd get choked up, you know, right. And you go like, man, like God, this is, he's carrying this, you know, when they brought the three cars in together, they didn't know, I don't think they knew that meant Miles wouldn't win. I mean, he thought he was still going to get the Triple Crown, but sure. B, you know, even given that he had all this stuff on, he had to toe the line. Shelby had to toe the line. He had, as Charlie Agape, you said to us, he had, you know, they had put, you know, tens of millions of dollars into this program. And what they thought and what he knew was, I'm going to come back here next year and Ken's going to win next year. Because we're going to win this thing again and again and again. Our car, Charlie, we asked Charlie, when you went over there, they'd already won Sebring, they'd already won Daytona that year.
Charlie Acapo?
Yeah. Charlie Agape. And when he, by the way, when
Spike interviews you guys, he's not doing a deep dive on Charlie Acapo. I know Charlie Acapo. I know. I've interviewed that guy.
He was around a lot, and he's wonderful.
Well, the thing that's crazy is these guys were doing this at 19, 20, 21. Yeah. So you meet the guy that was Ken Miles' right-hand man, and he's a 63-year-old guy. Like, you're like, he's not old.
Yeah.
It's crazy, and he has vivid memories.
Vivid memories.
He got choked up, of course, talking about Ken when I was interviewing him.
And I said, hey, Charlie, how sure were you when you guys went over there in 66? You know, they were dominating with that car. I said, how sure were you were going to win? And he was like, 100%. I said, really? He said, 100%. If we didn't break down, we were going to win. He goes, that car was just such a thug, and they knew it. And so I think to slow Ken down, you know what I mean? It's like it. They all have their own perspective. They all have their own, you know, ideas about why that happened. And it just was like Ford could not. They had put too much money into it to have the story be anything but the Ford car. It couldn't
be. I think also that with Shelby, he did ask Miles many times to do something strategic in a different race.
Right? Yes, yeah,
and
yeah.
Miles always bloody ignored him. Even sometimes he would laugh and be flipping him the bird to Shelby.
Right.
And I think Shelby kind of loved that, you know?
Right.
I think he knew, hey, look, I've got to do my duty. I have to ask. But there's no way Ken's going to do it. And then Ken bloody did it. Why? I think because Ken recognized how much Shelby had put on the line for him and wanted to give gratitude and did think he's still going to win the Triple Crown and did these bloody mind-blowing laps beforehand, only to then find he got screwed over.
Yeah, people don't know. You win Daytona, you win Sebring, you win Le Mans, you win the Triple Crown, sort of like horse racing, and no one had done
it in a season
up until then. Ken was obviously in a position to do that. I don't want to give away too much of the story, but, you know, if you think about, Matt, when you were saying, you know, they thought they were just going to come back every year and win every year, and
they did.
And rightfully so, and they did. You also think about Bruce McLaren, who did get the win, and he probably thought he was coming back, and then he died a couple years later testing, I think, a Can-Am car. So McLaren, the guy who surged ahead and got the win and blah, 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 he didn't have such a happy ending either in terms of terms of his life. The thing that's really poetic and interesting is here we are 50 years later, and McLaren, I saw a McLaren car in the parking lot.
Yeah.
I see Shelby cars in the parking lot. Now, 10 miles is going to be highlighted in this major film. Like, it is, I don't know, it gives you hope. It's kind of interesting that McLaren and Shelby and now Miles 50 years on, and here we are talking about them.
Yeah.
God, I don't think they could have ever imagined that, right?
No, I do hope that Miles becomes more of a common name, you know, because, you know, it was tragic, and he was so bloody talented. And like you said, within racing circles, I actually thought he was better known within racing circles than he is. That actually, many people don't even know him within those circles, and he really deserves. And coming from Britain as well.
Right.
That to be embraced as a bloody national hero for what he did.
And a lot
most
of
people have no idea.
A lot of ancillary people like Phil Remington.
Oh, yeah. He was so essential. You know, there was a triangle. It was really the three of them. And that was something that Peter said to me. He said, please make sure that you give Phil his credit because they could not have done it without him.
I interviewed Dan Gurney just before he passed, and I went down to his place where he's building stuff for SpaceX and everything else. Gurney's and another amazing story in the film, small role. Oh, his son.
Yeah,
played
Alex.
Played
Gurney. Yeah. And he showed me Phil Remington's workbench, who had just passed. I mean, he made it late. He said, that's where he worked for me. He still, we haven't touched his workspace. God, it's
there's
all,
so much to this story.
I know.
Mean, you could do, there is actually a, I think Legendary or somebody has the rights to one of the books that kind of covers documents this time. And I think they were still talking about doing a whole extended series on it. And they could totally still do it. I mean,
yeah, go like hell.
Yeah, go like hell. I mean, because you, because there's so many stories. I mean, the one drawback to doing a two and a half hour movie is like, you got to choose. You got to, and there's so, it's so full of different, you know, the great colorful characters and really interesting people. I mean, you could really do an extended run of this.
You know,
this era.
It's an onion, and you just, there's something, I did a movie called Winning the Racing Life of Paul Newman, and in the middle of that movie, we discovered a guy named Willie T. Ribbs, first African-American driver at Indianapolis, and then did our next one about him. Like, as you're making a doc about this one thing, you discover all these other stories, and they're all worth telling. It's just who's, you got to pick and choose because who's got the time to do it all? Are you guys, is there Oscar talk here? I mean, the movie was, I'll tell you, I saw the movie. Obviously, I knew everything going into the movie, and then I really loved the movie, but then I thought, maybe I love it like everyone thinks their kids are cute. Some of them are pigs, let's be honest.
They all look like Winston Churchill.
Yeah, but maybe this is just a father thinking his daughter should win the Miss Florida competition.
We just do our thing, and then it's up to other people to decide.
So, but I got back, and I was like, I don't know. I love this movie, but I don't know if I'm just preloaded to love it. And I looked on Rotten Tomatoes. It's 88% last time I checked.
Oh, I didn't even know they had anything up yet.
Oh, 60 folks have weighed in. And I got to tell you, in this woke area we're living in now, this all white, all male, all straight cast getting to 88% on Rotten Tomatoes, not too shabby. And they don't like car movies either.
Right, because they're gas guzzling.
Yeah, they're just wasting a bunch of vulcanized
rubber. That was actually
rubber.
A question we got a lot in France when we were in France.
We kept being asked, is it appropriate in this era with Greta Thunberg and the climate change and everything like that we made a film about cars that run on gas?
Right. Kristen said, should we go back and make them electric?
Why didn't you guys do Cool Runnings 3? They were just propelled by gravity. So I thought to myself, a really high score in a woke period where we don't like gas and petrol fuel being burned and all that kind of stuff, that says a lot. So there, and again, critics don't traditionally like car movies as much as other human stories. So there's got to be some discussion or some thought. I don't know if you guys are allowed to talk about it.
No, we don't discuss. We're not involved in any discussions about that.
But someone's going to put you for.
Well, someone does it, but nobody talks with us about it.
No, it just happens.
Do they talk with you about it?
No.
It's not just me they ignore.
But I never thought of this movie that way. Like, I, there's kind of an award season, which is, you know, the towards the end of the year. And this movie was supposed to come out in June.
Right.
And they just held on to it. And so I always just read it. I thought it was such a crowd-pleasing, like such a fun story. And such an interesting story, and one that I didn't know, and one that was really relatable, and that was kind of as far as I got with it. And so I'm glad it's being well received. That's great. Like, but to me, the big win would be if people just see it, go see it. Like, that's at this stage in my career. Like, that's really what I want more than anything. I want people to go, and I want people to like it.
Yeah, I feel the same way. At a certain point, you have enough money and enough stuff, and you just want. Your work, and you realize, like we're talking about 10 Miles. One day we're going to talk, and Carol Shelby. We're going to talk about the actors who played 10 Miles and Carol Shelby, and we'll all be roasting in hell. So I'll keep a seat open at the table for you guys. I think I'm going to get there first, but. Ultimately, it's about the work. It's about the body of work, and it's about people walking out of there going, "These guys did a great job." And if they kick it back for award season, which they did, which means they're thinking that way, that's just so much gravy.
It's a great problem to have.
They're telling me to bring it home, but so I'll just keep it another 23 minutes. I got to tell you, I love this film. I thought you guys both knocked it out of the ballpark. I thought that it's so James did a great job of shooting it. Yeah, it's not just a car show. It really is poetic. I mean, the shots, all the shots were just, you could tell in a way it's better to have a person like James direct a non-car guy. Like sometimes you get the Fast and Furious guys to do the things, you miss the artistry part.
Right.
So in a way it was even better. I thought it was amazing, and so kudos to both of you.
Thanks.
And if you want to see Peter Miles and you want to see that 9:35 at Laguna Seca, I'll be there too.
When is that going to be?
It's the middle of August. Single year they have the Rolex Historics over there, and all those guys come out, and we all race our cars.
Oh, great.
That's awesome.
So one more plug. In theaters Friday, November 15th, Ford v. Ferrari, and what a story. Great job, guys.
Right. Cheers, mate.
Thanks, Adam.
James Mangold, Ford v. Ferrari director, in theaters Friday, November 15th. Saw it. Loved it. Done so many movies, Logan and 310 to Yuma, which I enjoyed so much, Wolverine. Girl Interrupted. I forgot that was you. So good on you. Good to see you again, James.
Good to see you again, Adam.
I love the film. I had done a documentary on the film or the theme of the film, and I'd also just finished one on Carol Shelby. So going in, I was worried that I knew too much.
I knowing you were seeing it, I was worried that you knew too much.
The good news is I really don't know anything. So I enjoyed the hell out of this thing. And I thought
you
did a wonderful job.
You try and get the details right, of course, but what you're also trying to capture in a dramatic movie that you can't do as much in a documentary is you're trying to recreate a feeling or a vibe or a tone. You're trying to understand something about the personality of these guys that they might hide from a documentary camera, or something they may not show when they're doing an interview like this. You know, you're trying to get, in a way, behind the mask. What are they dealing with? You know, what are they haunted by? What are they chasing? And there's so many interesting aspects to these characters. Obviously, the cars are interesting. But, you know, you think about just Carol Shelby. He's top-notch racer in 1959, winning Le Mans in an Aston Martin, and suddenly finds out he's got a heart condition and can never race again, cannot get behind the wheel again.
Right.
What does that do? I mean, you can only imagine if you were suddenly told that all that joy and adrenaline and excitement and obsession you have about something is suddenly redirected and you can't do it anymore ever on a certain day, and that he had to reimagine his life on a day's notice and turned all that passion into building and designing and managing races. And that's so interesting. Then you take a cat like Ken Miles, who spent his prime years fighting World War II as a tank engineer, comes to this country, still wants to be a driver, is also interesting. You know, I'm not a big motorsports guy in that I learned it all watching and making this movie and watching all the research. But Ken Miles is also an example of a day and age when the drivers could also fix their own cars. You know, that these were people who understood, who built the car, were the people who drove the car.
Yeah, you had to sort of wear a couple of hats back then. And a lot of those Shelby guys, there's a guy named John Morton who's was a Shelby driver, and then he moved on with Pete Brock. Pete Brock built the Daytona, famously, that won the Manufacturers Championship, as seen in the movie as well. But these guys drove and built their own cars. And
there's a romance to that. I mean, I don't want to say it's better or worse. I think that as we all get more specialized, there is something that we're robbed of, which is that kind of renaissance, man or woman, of racing or of anything, that people who build something, who start from zero and deliver it to the final destination, there's something romantic about that. That as modern life has gone on, we get robbed of. We don't get to understand that kind of pride.
And so when you talk to modern day race car drivers as a gearhead, and they're telling me they're driving an F1 car, and I go, "What's the displacement on the motor?" And they go, "I don't know." Right. And my feeling is like, I get it. They're good at what they do, but if there was a barbecue joint and it was run by a vegan, I wouldn't go in. I want a guy who lives
pork.
The life.
Yes,
he gets high on his own supply.
Yes. You want that.
And also the cars back then, because I've talked to a lot of these guys who raced Le Mans then and now. And then it was a lot about endurance, reliability. Famously in the movie, I won't give it away, but Phil Remington, the designer, engineer, sort of extraordinaire, comes up with a way to make the brakes last longer and blah, blah, blah. They had to drive. I've interviewed Dan Gurney on this. They had to make those cars last. Now they drive the car at 10 tenths for the whole race because everything's synthetic and the cars are so durable and the computers work and everything and doing everything that they don't have to simultaneously race the car and sort of maintain the car.
No, it is so different now. I mean, what makes Le Mans so interesting and was for me as I did the research on the movie was that it is not a race that is all just as it was first created as a race. It wasn't only about winning. It was about surviving. It's a race as old, as you well know, as the automobile itself, and was a way of putting cars on a road and seeing who had built a vehicle that could just stand that kind of usage, that kind of test. A lot of what crosses the finish line at Le Mans is not about people who have fallen in the 10th or 20th position, but usually about people who just fall away in the past. I don't think that's as true anymore. But
no, and there was a strategy. I mean, you'd send one guy out to be the rabbit.
Right.
Hopefully the other guy would chase him and break.
Right.
We show some of that in the picture.
But that is the point. And then you have these cars, because it's a dawning moment in car design, the cars themselves have more personality because they're a little more lopsided. You know, now we've gotten to this kind of tipping point where they can, through computer design and just experience, the cars are all pretty good all around. There was a time when you might have a car that was nimble, but it didn't have the torque that another car had. You might have like the GT40 had all this power, but what they knew from the moment they had kind of put that engine in the GT40, at least as I understand it, they kind of knew they were faster than anyone else. They just didn't know if they could stop or turn. So the reality is each car has such a unique personality, and you get to see these racers and Shelby in the pits, and they're all, and you know, Remington, they're all dealing with the unique personality of the monster they've created. Ferrari too, in the sense that the Ferrari has its advantages and disadvantages.
I noticed a lot of filming at Willow Springs, which is a track I'm very familiar with, and I was thinking
it's hot there.
Cool.
I mean, when the scenes you're shooting, the guys, I don't know how they don't sweat. I never know this about movie stars, just what they do to make the sweat never occur. But we're shooting at 120 degrees, and I have obviously looked like a overheated lobster,
right?
Hulk clinging to a slice of watermelon. But the shoot itself, you don't feel that. You feel the joy of that. Well, it is I was transported back. It made me want to race and drive. Driving out for the weekend with a bunch of gearheads and tooling around one of these beautiful tracks. It's beautiful.
Willow Springs, as I was watching the movie, and I've done a professional Trans Am race and a vintage races and stuff there, it struck me that you didn't have to touch a thing.
We very little.
Because that place hasn't changed since 1957.
And it's thrilling because the real characters were making the movie about race there, and they haven't touched a thing. And what I love about it is it hasn't been turned into some Ed DeBevick Sha-na-na kind of like nostalgic thing.
Right.
It just is what it was. It's not been turned into some kind of touristy thing.
There's no Marilyn Monroe mannequin that greets you in the gift shop or anything.
Yeah, it's just the place like it's been always.
I know. I was thrilled watching it. And we're talking to Christian about the car nerds are always like, this bumped me and that bumped me. The only thing
the car nerds.
The only thing in the entire film that bumped me is there was a couple of shots where you were going the wrong way
on track.
Willow Springs.
Yes.
Yes.
Was that in the later sequence when they're testing the car? Because that's what we did intentionally.
I was like, they're going the wrong direction, but I was like, you're the only person in this theater that knows. And
right.
I'm sure
I don't think we shot the races going the wrong direction. No. There's a later sequence where they're testing the GT 40 when they end up tying the yarn to it that we did shoot. I think we shot it going the wrong way in a couple places.
Yeah.
Trying to freshen up the shots a little bit. I figure when you were testing on the track, you can drive any which way.
Drive any way you want.
Yeah.
It's such an amazing film, and it's, I was worried that I was going to love it, but that America wasn't going to love it because they don't like cars.
That is a central worry of mine too. I'm glad you
well,
do.
But the story of Ken and his son and what happened to Ken and the sort of tragedy of Ken Miles after I made my doc when I thought I was just making a doc about sort of Ferrari versus Ford, like the film. And I realized, Ken Miles, this is the human story in this whole big macro-ness of the whole thing, the micro is really Ken, his son, his wife, and his tragedy.
Well, also, he was such a wonderful character. Everyone remembers him with such clarity. And the way his friendship intersected, the way him and Shelby's friendship was so mutually beneficial, how they each needed each other in a way, Ken to be Carol's kind of driver, his almost a projection of himself behind the wheel, and that Ken would never get a chance to drive if it wasn't for Carol, because Ken was a handful, you know, and that to me was so interesting. And then a lot of the relationships were interesting. I found Henry Ford II really interesting. I mean, the idea of being a legacy running this company that makes kind of slightly boring cars, affordable cars for the working man, and then you have a guy like Enzo who's much more of a maverick. He's no legacy. He created this company, who makes unaffordable cars for almost no man.
Right.
And each man has something on the corporate side, each man has something the other wants. Ford wants to be cool. Ferrari wants to be solvent.
Right.
You know, and that and it's in so many ways, the characters, it extrapolates out of racing and becomes about all the decisions we make in life and the choices we can make about the type of person we want to be, the way we pursue our goals, that either bankrupt us or enrich us, but we go, how did I get on this track doing this boring shit? And that it's like the efforts to kind of change your track. Even Ford, I'm very moved by Henry Ford. He's trying to change it up. You know, he's trying to, and one great scene where, you know, Matt's character Shelby takes Henry Ford II out for a drive. I always find it very moving because you suddenly realize this imperious kind of, intimidating executive is also really living in a bubble and is kind of sad and never gets to taste on the ground level what it is they do.
That actor, is it Tracy Letts?
Yeah.
He was fantastic.
He's a Pulitzer Prize winning playwright as well, but he's a really? Great actor. Yeah, he's
The guy who played Remington, Ray McKinnon, I thought that guy was awesome as well. And it's
he was in Deadwood. He created a great series for years, and he's a great. He also is a great writer. It's a really interesting group of people we gathered together.
And the way it was shot was just magnificent.
Thank you.
It looked so good.
Well, great DP, Faden Papamichael, and we've worked together on five movies. And I've done a lot of commercials in my life, and I didn't want the movie to look like a car commercial, but I did want it to be beautiful. I wanted you to feel it as real. Like sometimes when you're shooting car commercials, everything gets so creamy and beautiful that every car looks, obviously no one wants to see their car dirty.
Right.
Here, part of the sexiness is the dirt, is the dust, is the sense that they're being used. And one of the interesting factoids I know from my other life making other kinds of movies and also doing this is, you know, a lot of the characters I met, especially the Willow Springs, Southern California racing characters, they all knew George Lucas because mm-hmm. he was a hot rodder and he would hang right. out. He would sleep on a lot of their couches and was at Willow Springs and all these places. And for those Star Wars fans, part of the reason that all those spaceships, even in the very first Star Wars, the Millennium Falcon, the X-Wings, look so soiled is
right.
because of George Lucas's experiences in drag racing and in racing, and that all that exhaust staining and all that stuff was his influence of trying to kind of carry something. It's like, why is everything perfectly clean in outer space?
Right.
It certainly isn't on a track.
Yeah, American Graffiti is Lucas,
a great movie. And yeah,
right,
and Harrison Ford plays a drag racer with
Bel-Air, Jack, I think.
Yeah.
55? I think he's driving a Bel-Air.
It's a great movie if you haven't seen it.
A great soundtrack, too.
It is. It's an impossible to afford soundtrack now.
So they're telling me to bring it home. So I'll heap some praise. I knew the story well. I loved it. And I was confirmed,
Adam,
when I went to Rotten Tomatoes and saw it at 88%, which, again, is an amazing score. Because critics don't like car movies and ones where you burn a lot of fossil fuels and vulcanized rubber. They might deduct a couple of points for that. What's next?
I can't tell you for sure what's next. I'm working on a couple other things, nothing like this, but something interesting. I mean, I am always trying to move. Maybe something with music, maybe something with guns. I don't know. Maybe something in the woods. That's the most I'd say right now.
Jerry Lee Lewis?
No, but good guess.
Well, it's guns and music. So congratulations.
Thank you, Adam.
It was just a great film, and in a way, as I told Matt and Christian, I think finding a non-car guy to make this film, to really tell the story and to really make it look as well as it looked. And by the way, for those who watched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and sort of dug all the 70s, 60s, 70s vibe, you got that going in spades. I mean, it is a real throwback.
A time capsule. Yeah, well, it's such a great time in this country when people were making things and risking themselves making things. You couldn't figure it out on a computer first. You had to put your body in the chassis and see whether it held together as it made the turn.
Well,
you know?
Imagine living in California and in Venice Beach, a guy like Carroll Shelby just showing up and opening up a shop.
No,
like
it's incredible.
I'm going to hire a bunch of young guys, going to import. Those cars would be impounded. They'd be at the docks. They'd be gray market vehicles.
Yeah.
The EPA would be there going, what
no,
are you
it would
doing?
Be impossible. But you think about this. I didn't even put a label on the scenes. But when Shelby American got the deal with Ford to develop the car, they were doing it at LAX. And well, you well know
sure.
this, but most people don't know this. And that the, you know, because where are you going to drive these cars every day at that kind of speed? Where are you going to find that kind of blacktop? And the airports at that point were closed during most of the night. So they built a garage off of LAX in a hangar. And all that racing you see is you know, where we land now when we're coming in from New York or LA or Hong Kong or wherever. That was the proving ground for the GT40 with those runways.
Simpler times. James, thank you so much for coming in and sharing some time with us. Ford
My
v
pleasure.
Ferrari theaters, Friday, November 15th. I saw it, and I shall bring my son and see
it's
it again.
It's a good movie. You can bring also, you can bring non-racing people. I think
absolutely.
Absolutely. Yes. Anyway, thank you
Thanks,
so much.
James.
Pleasure.